Ben and Joe's, written by Martin Foreman, read by John Vernon. Did you ever go to Ben and Joe's? It was a reasonably popular bar in the valley at the far end of Van Nuys, beyond the radar of the West Hollywood crowd. Mostly locals, although a few would come from as far away as Pasadena or Silver Lake. It wasn't everyone's idea of a trendy gay bar. I'm sure some people who drove up to the Art Deco front with a tired flamingo on the door and peeling paint did a quick U-turn, convinced that it held only a handful of solitary middle-aged men who no longer expected their prince to come. They were wrong. Most evenings the place was full. 20 to 50-year-olds, half of whom had already found their prince and the other half too busy to look for him. Typical valley men, supermarket managers and haulage contractors, IT technicians and flight attendants, and the inevitable studio wannabes, drinking, laughing, flirting, and dancing till the early hours. It wasn't my scene. I was one of the afternoon shift. We were the older generation who strolled in an hour or so after the daily routine of lunch, shopping, or the gym. We'd perch on stools around the crescent-shaped bar, watch old films on the TV, and pass judgment on politicians, film stars, and anyone else in the day's news. Our favorite game was encouraging Richard, the impossibly handsome 23-year-old barman, to invent outrageous cocktails. We would stay until the early evening, when we were surrounded by more strangers than acquaintances, and the door swinging open showed that the last of the stores across the road had closed. Then by ones or by twos, we drained our glasses and returned home to a lover, a pet, or a memory. To outsiders, I'm sure we all looked the same. Middle-aged, white, retired, or jobless, mostly single, no responsibilities, quiet lives, and a Californian tan. To each other, of course, we were very different.
There was Peter, mid-50s, once a hairdresser in New Jersey. Tall and handsome with thick gray hair and a still visible waistline. Each glass of wine would make him sparkle, but occasionally he'd turn to bourbon and lash out at the world in cruelty and anger. Roy was a little older with tired dark eyes and unnaturally brown hair. He'd spent half his life in Europe with a succession of young men who loved him passionately, but never for long. Now he lived in Canoga Park, on a street full of sour-faced adolescents and shrieking children. Steve claimed to be 49, a New England lawyer with Paul Newman's voice and smile, who had moved west when his partner of 20 years died. Tom from Wisconsin and Fernando from Spain were dog breeders in their early 60s. Eddie, way overweight, shy and with a stutter, always insisted there was no place finer to live than a mobile home. Jack was a part-time realtor who could never retire. Frank was on disability and lived with a Latino who ran a hospital ward.
Then there was Jarrett, who dabbled in the stock market and, some said, underage boys.
Finally, Keith, intense, thin, 20 years older than his 34-year-old lover, a lover who had been in prison for 10 years and who, Keith prayed, would be freed in 15 more.
There were other regulars, but we were the core, the ones who always turned to greet a friend or stare at a stranger when the door opened and the heat and light streamed in.
Creatures of habit who dropped by every day and who seldom wandered further than the nearest Target or shopping mall.
men whose idea of excitement was a monthly escort, who stood bored as we ran our hands over his body. We did not see ourselves as losers. We were convinced that the couples who ran successful businesses or who vacationed in Mexico and planned their retirement in Russian River were no happier than we were. After all, our lives had been eventful. We had long and complicated stories to tell. Each of us had suffered in our different ways, and because we had suffered, we had lived. Now we were free to shut out the present and the past, the noise and the dust, the freeways and the rat race, the threats of earthquakes and violence. Life may have shrunk, but life was quiet, and quiet was good. We seldom saw our hosts. Ben was an antique dealer of the same vintage as ourselves. Joe, 15 years younger, had been a farm boy in Indiana. The bar was their abandoned child. The counter was chipped, the carpet thin, and the restrooms occasionally smelled. Richard and the night manager saw to immediate repairs, but promised improvements never materialized.
"No money," Joe would tell us on his infrequent visits.
We reminded him that money had to be spent if money was to be earned. He nodded absently, and nothing changed. We didn't care. All we asked was air conditioning, cold beer, ice in our liquor, and Richard behind the bar.
From Louisiana. 6 foot, well-proportioned, with an accent that we loved, and he could not lose.
He flirted routinely with every man. We had each propositioned him once, and each been politely rebuffed. We were content thereafter to sit and listen to tales of crazy acting teachers, casting agencies that promised Universal Studios and delivered pornographic films, and muscular 29-year-olds who calmly pocketed his affection before climbing into their jeeps and riding back over the Hollywood Hills. One day, we assured him, he would find love and stardom, but we privately hoped not soon. So our days passed like a gentle soap opera, where the characters and lines never change, only the order in which they come. Christmas came and went, and came again with Jimmy Stewart and Richard's Punch. Winter saw day-long downpours that stalled cars and flooded streets. Summer brought sweat and torpor. Then, one August day, as some of us watched The Twilight Zone and the rest half listened to Keith's theories on mineral supplements, the door swung open and Jack strode in with a tall black youth in South Central clothes. Jack wasn't the only one of us to occasionally bring in young men, nor was this the first of his that we had seen, but Jack's usual taste ran to Italian bodybuilders in their late 20s who featured as second-line stars in pornographic videos and worked as lumbering dancers in nightclubs, which made this 19-year-old lanky stranger an anomaly. As Jack came to the bar, the boy stood back, silent and uncomfortable in the half-light, with an expression that we each interpreted according to our own individual prejudices as caution, timidity, aggression, or contempt. Jack greeted us and ordered 2 beers before introducing his companion. In turn, we nodded or raised a glass or a hand. 1 or 2 gave their names. There was a flicker of acknowledgement in the boy's eyes before his gaze fell to the bottle in his hand.
"Christopher's a mechanic for Nissan in Studio City," Jack went on. "Just finished his shift, thought I'd bring him in for a drink."
There was a moment's silence. None of us had a Nissan, and we couldn't come up with alternative topics of conversation. Two or three, already bored, turned back to the Twilight Zone, the episode where a 19th-century settler walks into a 1960s diner in the middle of the desert. Jack started telling Frank about a dispute he had with Fry's at Burbank, and Christopher was forgotten by all but one or two of us. Steve tried to talk to him, remembering when he had once been young and tongue-tied, but the young man's responses were so quiet and monosyllabic that it was soon clear he preferred torture by silence to torture by interrogation. 20 minutes later, they left. "To repossess some workshops," said Jack. Christopher was going to give his opinion on the machinery. Privately, we doubted the boy's expertise. Aloud, we said goodbye and watched our short, balding friend guide the slender, slick-haired teenager to the door. After they had gone, we looked at each other and wondered. It was Eddie who voiced the question, "What does Jack see in the kid?" The rest of us shrugged our shoulders. Keith was sure we would not see him again. Steve said the boy seemed pleasant enough, and that was the end of it. Meet Me in St. Louis had just started, and for most of us, it was time for a refill. Keith was wrong. 2 days later, Christopher and Jack returned. The street clothes were gone, replaced by regular jeans and a light blue polo shirt. Gone, too, was some of the young man's reticence. He spoke when spoken to, and even voiced his opinion about a football game. His voice was high and unsettled, almost effeminate, and he made the effort to use our grammar instead of his own. It was soon clear that Jack and Christopher were an item, and after several visits, the young man began to relax in our company. Some of us began to like him, attracted by an uncertain but upright personality struggling to emerge from adolescence. Others were less generous, seeing only the hunger for money and status common to many of Christopher's background and age. Not that that was necessarily a problem. It was Roy who said that young men who get rich by offering sex for financial reward are only taking the shortcut for which most gay men lack courage. He was more at ease with some of us than others. Steve, the ex-lawyer, could talk to him as a near equal, but he could also relax with Eddie, with whom we assumed he shared a childhood of poverty. With Tom and Fernando, he could discuss dogs for hours. Most often, however, he would talk with young Richard behind the bar. Some of us eavesdropped on their conversations, but could not join in. We no longer knew the language of youth. Its concepts and concerns were now too foreign. Still, we watched from the sidelines, remembering young men we had known and young men we had been. Of course, the boy was often bored. If Steve was not there, Richard was busy, and Jack's attention was elsewhere, he would sit alone watching the TV or playing the pinball machines that we ignored. It was at such moments when he was silent, rather than when he spoke, that his presence altered the mood in the bar. Then he was set apart from us, a stranger stigmatized by his youth, his skin color, and his attitude. Some of us watched him and resented his presence disturbing our quiet lives. Others welcomed the reminder of the world that existed beyond the dark walls of this, our home from home. When we talked about him in his absence, we did so carefully. On the surface, we prided ourselves on our tolerance. Jared claimed Cherokee blood, and two or three of us were Jewish. Once, Keith suggested that no black man who ended up in jail was innocent, but the statement made several of us uncomfortable. The subject of race, having raised its head and eyed each of us in turn, settled down again to sleep. We stepped carefully round it and hoped that it would slip away. Time passed. Between the two, we witnessed a deepening bond that the romantics among us saw as love. For the cynics, however, Christopher was merely exchanging sex for money, while Jack was driven, as some of us also were, to fight off age and solitude with Viagra and dollar bills. I was on the side of the romantics, convinced that in the young man's eyes and voice there was a growing affection for his companion. Perhaps the affection was returned. Was it possible, we wondered, that behind Jack's oversized ego and volatile moods, there lay a vulnerability or sense of honor that only the younger man could see? By mid-October, however, our attention had drifted. Eddie's deepening depression worried those of us who liked him. With no health insurance, his options were limited, and the prescription drugs he came by, he took so erratically as to have no effect. Our barman's mood had also changed. Richard had set himself a goal of a speaking part in a Hollywood movie by the end of the year. Otherwise, he would move to Seattle and put himself through business school. The decision changed him. He became all efficiency and no humor, like the bartenders on Santa Monica Boulevard. We tried to change his mind, but he would not be swayed, and his departure loomed like night on the horizon. But from time to time, there was good news. Roy won some money on the lottery and now had the wisdom to save and spend it wisely. Fernando became a citizen at last. Steve began dating a doctor for Ventura, and even I lost weight through regular attendance at the gym. Then one day, when the sky was gray and the wind was dry, a reminder of a time when the streets outside had once been desert, four or five of us were in the bar when the door opened and Christopher came in alone. "Had we seen Jack?" he asked. "No, we hadn't." "Did we know where he might be?" "No, we didn't." The boy was on edge. Jack's cell was switched off, and he was not at home or his one-man office. We asked what the urgency was. If Steve had been there, or perhaps Eddie, Christopher might have replied, but confronted by older men who usually treated him with disdain and suspicion, he only shook his head and left. As the door swung to behind him, we saw him standing on the sidewalk, looking left and right as if not knowing where to go, what to do, as if the future scared him. In the half-light of the bar, Frank called Jack and left a message. It was 2 hours before Jack phoned back, by which time others had drifted in and were brought up to date. On the surface, we appeared as laid back as ever, but each was on edge, unsettled by the weather and Christopher's appearance and mood. When Jack's call came, we listened to Frank's monosyllables and brief questions. Then Frank calmly sipped his vodka before announcing that Jack was with the police, alerting them to the fact that Christopher had taken his car and a considerable amount of property from his house. Most of us were surprised. A few were vindicated. We threw together instant theories and bandied opinions with the energy of a jury ripping apart and chewing over evidence. But we were a jury without a trial or foreman, and our arguments went round in circles. On one side were Steve and Eddie, convinced that Christopher was innocent, otherwise he would not have looked for Jack. Opposing them were Keith and Frank, who saw the action as diverting the older man while accomplices drove away with the booty. Someone else suggested the young man had indeed committed the crime, but immediately regretted his actions and wanted to make amends. The more we talked, the more ill feeling between us grew.
Keith accused the boy's defenders of being liberal wimps. Steve implied that those who believed his guilt were racist. Tempers flared as Eddie tried to calm us down. By the end of the afternoon, we each sat in our own pool of anger, less concerned with the truth of the day's events than with the naivety or prejudices of those around us. For some, the situation echoed with half-forgotten memories. Money stolen from Roy by a youth in Italy. A shivering hustler to whom Steve once gave a lift. The day Peter came home to find his lover in bed with a man twice his age. The rape which Keith's lover suffered his first week in jail. We left in ones and twos, driving home to apartments which that night seemed sad and empty. The next day we hurried back to the bar. The word from Jack was that the police had been to Christopher's house, but there had been no sign of the boy or Jack's property.
"That means nothing," said Keith. "Of course he wouldn't go home. He'd sell everything as soon as he could."
What was it that he could sell? What we expected. Camera, sound system, jewelry, money, perhaps $10,000 worth, which he might be able to sell for $1,000.
"He won't get anything," came a voice from behind the bar. "He didn't do it."
We turned to Richard, surprised by the authority and bitterness in his tone.
"He didn't do it," he repeated.
We asked for proof. It appeared that Christopher had called him and told him what had happened. A cousin had turned up with two friends at Jack's house while Jack was out. The four of them had driven to Santa Monica in Jack's car, and while Christopher and the cousin hung out on 3rd Street, the friends disappeared. When the two of them returned to the car park, the Nissan was gone. The rest of the story was confusion. Christopher's fear and anger, the cousin concocting an alibi, Christopher trying to find Jack to tell him. When they finally spoke, nothing Christopher said could persuade Jack to believe him. Richard's explanation did not satisfy us all. Keith was convinced that the story was bullshit. The youth had been in on the robbery but got cold feet. "They always do," he said. Steve asked what Keith meant by "they."
"Kids like Christopher," said Keith. "You know what I mean."
"Black kids," said Steve.
"I didn't say that," said Keith.
From the silence of his corner came Eddie's high-pitched voice, surprisingly determined.
"It's what you meant."
"Look facts in the face," said Frank. "It's true."
Then came voice after voice. Accusation after accusation was flung across the bar, fueled by anger and contempt. Those of us who were at first in the middle found ourselves swayed one way or the other by prejudices against our drinking companions that we did not even know existed. A few, sickened by the outburst, sat silent and tried in vain to follow Judge Judy on television. Suddenly, Richard's voice came above all the others.
"Fuck you! Fuck yourselves! Fuck all of you! I've had it!"
And we watched, surprised, as he tore off his apron, pushed open the door to the office, and came back out with his jacket in his hand.
"You can't leave," said Jarrett.
"Just watch me," Richard replied, striding towards the door and jerking it open.
For a moment, it revealed a world of sunlight behind his silhouette. Then it slammed shut, leaving us in the shadows and the sudden nasal voice of New York from the TV. For a few moments, no one spoke.
"That was an overreaction," said Peter.
"He's young," Steve said, "but maybe he has the right idea." He drained his glass, stood up, and said he would see us around. Roy followed. The door closed behind them, and there was a long silence in which we looked at the empty space behind the bar and became aware of the abyss that had opened up around us.
"I guess we should call Ben or Joe," Keith said, but
No one made a move. We sat in silence until Frank reached for the remote and found a movie channel, The African Queen. As Hepburn and Bogart drifted down the river one by one, we finished our drinks. Some left. Others helped themselves to refills, piling up fives and tens by the register for the evening shift. When we talked, it was hesitantly, as if we were strangers that would not meet again. By the end of the afternoon, only Frank and Keith were left to tell the night manager that a new bartender was required for the afternoon. Those of us who returned to Ben and Joe's in the days that followed were greeted by Arthur, a 30-year-old stranger who was too professional and casual. We spoke little to each other, waiting for Jack and news of Christopher that never came. Over the next few weeks, we all found other ways to spend our time. A bar further away, a hobby or home repairs that we had neglected. Early in the new year, those of us who drove by Ben and Joe's saw the door bolted and a for sale sign displayed. It was not our absence that had caused the bar to close. What the afternoon crowd had spent was minimal, but nevertheless, we felt responsible. As time went by, few of us drove down the street. But sometimes one of us would pass and glance at the now headless Flamingo. Then we would remember, with differing emotions, the many days we had spent there idling away our lives, and the day we sat watching the twilight zone when a young black man entered the place that had been almost our home. That was Ben and Joe's, a story written by Martin Foreman, read by John Vernon.
Hear more drama and fiction, old and new, on arburyproductions.co.uk.
Arbury.